Welcome, everybody, to Crystal Kyle and Friends. Today, I am very excited because we have in studio a bit of a legend, if I don't say so myself. This is Madea Benjamin of Code Pink. Madea, thank you so much for joining us. We're really excited for this.
I'm so excited to be here. I watch you two all the time.
Thank you. That's quite a compliment.
It sure is. Very flattering. It is an honor to have you here. So thank you so much for spending some time with us, especially because I know you've been very busy. Maybe just update folks on what actions you've been taking even just this week on Capitol Hill.
Oh my goodness, every day is so crazy. I mean, yesterday there was Secretary of Defense. Oh no, that was last week. Lloyd Austin, who we interrupted during his presentation, in which he then said that there was no evidence of any genocide. Then we had Samantha Power. And we told her that she's supposed to be the expert on preventing genocide. So what's she doing to prevent genocide? This morning, we were at a hearing of to protect journalists. And the chairperson was Chip Roy. Don't know if you know Chip Roy. Mm-hmm. He's not really one who protects journalists. Mm-hmm. And we got up and we talked about the 95 journalists in Gaza who've been killed and what is he doing about that. And, you know, then we just bird dog them all the time as they go in and out. And so we catch them saying the most vile things. Mm-hmm. But then we also talk to some of the good ones. We saw Rashida this morning, and we talked to her about what kind of new bills, what kind of new resolutions, what kind of new letters that we have to get people on. So, and we also have regular meetings, actually. We mm-hmm. go and we meet with the Congress people, with the staff people, and we're just there every single day.
Have you been, has anything about their reaction surprised you? Positive, negative,
well, I must say that I am still in shock that Nancy Pelosi signed a letter saying that we should withhold weapons to Israel. I mean, we have been pressuring Nancy Pelosi forever. And our colleagues in San Francisco, they've been literally camping out at her home. They've been lying down in front of her car. They have been going to any meeting that she attends. And we have been doing the same in D.C. There's a great clip of her when I'm running after her, and she's going like this. Boy, like I'm a fly, you know, shoo, shoo. And she has been such a great supporter of Israel, and she's wouldn't you say she's like the most important Democrat in the House side?
Yeah, she raises the most money, so absolutely.
Yeah, money. So that's what seems to count the most.
And she's a good friend of Joe Biden's. So for her to sign this letter, the important thing to say is, you know, it's always a combination of things. Mm-hmm. It's the horrific situation in Gaza. It's that she was friends with Jose Andres. And when mm-hmm. she saw those World Central Kitchen workers being killed, I think that affected her. But it's, you know, grassroots pressure does matter. And I think we have to take a little bit of credit for that. Now, she'll move back and she'll say, well, I only meant until they do an investigation about the World Central Kitchen. It doesn't really matter about the 33,000 people in Gaza who've been killed. I'm sure she'll be backstepping ASAP.
But she already has been.
She has been. Yeah. I've seen that. I didn't want to say it because it kind of takes away from the good feeling.
Yeah.
But anyway, that is something that shocked me.
I thought it was extraordinary, too. Even, you know, even as you read the letter, you're saying like, okay, well, there's a lot of wiggle room here. But the fact that you even have someone like Nancy Pelosi opening the door to conditioning aid would have been unthinkable just a few months ago. The fact that you have Chuck Schumer having to make the argument, no, I don't think it's apartheid, but having to make that argument and saying, hey, we need a new government here.
Yeah.
I mean, that is extraordinary. I do think it's a testament in part to the work that you all have been doing. You know, Pelosi has also, even as she signed this letter and acknowledged the pressure she's been under, she also had to, you know, she's been smearing you all as, oh, this is, they're basically traitors. You know, this
paid
is
paid for
doing
by the Communist Party of China. She said, go back to your headquarters in China, which is just so insane.
Right.
And we're getting that from others. They say, you know, they're agents of the Iranian government. They're Chinese. It used to be when we tried to advocate for peace in Ukraine, right. It was Russia.
Russia was the one she actually just said, too, on, I believe it was Morning Joe when she was getting asked about
every enemy country they go through, like Venezuela.
Cuba, right. Absolutely. So we had this fun action in the office of John James, who's a Republican, who tweeted out that these troublemakers of Code Pink are paid for by the Chinese Communist Party. So we said, okay, let's do a visit to his office. We went to his office and we hid all this money around. And we said, oh my God, we found the money. Is this from the Chinese Communist Party? No, it says AIPAC. And it actually has blood on the money. This must be for the congressman.
That's
right. So, you know, we make a joke out of it, but it's not funny, really. Right. It's dangerous and it's libelous and it's insulting to all the people that come with Code Pink who are not paid by anybody. I mean, they're really struggling to come in whenever they can. They take sick days from work, they're retired people, they're students, and they're really sacrificing a lot to go into those halls of Congress every day. So, you know, we think it's important. We ask for a retraction, of course.
So let me ask you this, because for the longest time, when you look at the actions of these politicians, you know, you could trace AIPAC support, Israel lobby support, DMFI support, et cetera, to, you know, kind of coincide with their perspective. Also, some of them are genuinely like ideological Zionists. But at what point does the immense grassroots pressure sort of change the calculation for these politicians where they feel like, well, you know, it was what Mark Lamont Hill told us. Remember, he said there's never been consequences for a U.S. president supporting Israel too much. But now that's changing. Right. So at what point does the calculation change where these politicians feel like I don't have a choice but to be more skeptical of Israel, question Israel, cut off some of the money to Israel? Because there really is. I would say you represent the silent majority in the country. You know what I mean? Like the polling shows you represent the silent majority. At what point did they kind of wake up to that and go, the AIPAC money isn't even worth it because I'm going to lose my election because I'm, you know, riding for Israel so hard that I'm pissing off all my constituents.
Absolutely. I mean, you almost see their brain going when you're trying to talk to them. They're saying, uh-oh, you know, what can I say to not piss off AIPAC too much? But, you know, the people back in my district, for example, Glenn Ivey, I mean, he's a great example of that. He owes his position to AIPAC. And, you know, he is, when he's kind of funny because usually when we say to them, are you influenced at all by AIPAC money? They're oh, how insulting that you would think that I would base my position on money. But Glenn Ivey says, well, you know, not really.
That's hilarious.
Appreciate the candor,
Appreciate the candor, like he's thinking about it, you know, because he's getting a lot of pressure from his grassroots. Mm. So you can see and feel that they are torn by that. And yes, when you say what the opinion polls show, I mean, let's go back to 2 weeks after October 7th, when there was an AP poll, and that was the one that showed 66% of Americans wanted a ceasefire back then.
Right.
80% of Democrats. And then was the same time that Cori Bush put out her resolution, and that only got 18 votes. So 18 votes, that's less than 5% of Congress. So you should have 80% of the Democrats. I mean, where were they? And so all this time, we have been representing the not-so-silent majority because people are speaking up. I mean, let's face it, these in certain districts, they cannot go anywhere in their district without people protesting them. So I think the calculation is definitely changing. I mean, you see it in Senator Van Hollen. Mm-hmm. I just spoke to him yesterday and, you know, thanked him for being a champion now for not only getting the humanitarian aid into Gaza, because I think he got mad when he went to the border and he saw himself all those trucks lined up and came home and said, you know, this is unacceptable. But then he went a step further and he's talking about the weapons. Now, we've had meetings in his office after he came back from the border and they thought we were going to be, oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And everyone, including mostly the Palestinians who were in there saying, you know, it makes me even feel worse that you went and you saw our pain, and yet you're still in favor of sending more weapons and you voted for the supplemental. And I think that kind of thing, you know, gets to him. And he now has put out this position of no more weapons, a stronger position than the Mark Pocan letter that Nancy Pelosi signed on to, which many people are calling the Nancy Pelosi letter.
How do you handle a situation like that? Because, you know, I found myself thinking this through in the context of Senator Warren's comments recently, where she said, you know, if you're talking legally, it is a genocide. And I think she said they have ample evidence to prove it. Then, of course, she walks, oh, well, you know, that wasn't my personal opinion. That's just I'm assessing a legal process, et cetera, et cetera. But so I want to applaud those comments. But at the same time, I can't ignore the fact that the votes you've taken are contrary to those comments, unless you support a genocide, because, you know, you're voting to defund UNRWA, you're voting to ship weapons. So do you prefer the approach tactically of saying, great, welcome, we're glad you're here? Or do you prefer the approach of doing that and a little bit of, yeah, but these votes in the past, what are we going to do about that? How do you, what do you think is the best way to move politicians and regular people to our side?
I think it's important to thank them for any little thing they do that moves them in the right direction and then say, but we need you to stop sending the weapons because you're in control. You're supposed to be in the control of purse strings. Now, the weird thing is, not weird, but the tragedy is that Biden keeps sending these weapons anyway and going around them. But in any case, you know, they are the ones who are supposed to control the budget. They're supposed to control the money. And so we say to them, all of these things that you say are nice, but we want to see it in your votes. And we want you to be out there more vocally. We want you to take a lead position. We want you to get your colleagues. You know, we've been saying that to Bernie Sanders, and we've been saying that to Chris Van Hollen. You know, your position is one of the best, but what are you doing to get your other senators on board? So it's a thank you, but not far enough.
Yeah, I think that makes sense because you don't want people to feel like, oh, there's nothing I could do to please these people. But at the same respect, you want them to realize, okay, but there's more. Now that you hold this position, there's more that you need to do.
Yeah, and we say, for example, to Chris Van Hollen, when he voted for that supplemental, he said, well, I had to do it for Ukraine. And we say, nothing justifies voting for more weapons to Israel. Nothing justifies that. And other people have said, oh, I had to do it because there was humanitarian aid in there. And we said, oh, my goodness, you know, bomb them and feed them or feed them and bomb them? Which one do you want to? Yeah. So, yes, we are always holding them to a higher standard.
So I want to take a step back here because I'm very interested in your personal story and Code Pink and the founding and how we get to where we are right now. What made you want to become this legendary anti-war activist? What was it in your childhood that happened or please explain for people?
Well, I didn't want to become anti-war activists. I wanted to be a journalist. You know? I used to work for the United Nations. I wanted to be a healthcare worker. I wanted to feed hungry children. But I was born during the Vietnam War days, and there was this aha moment for me when my sister's boyfriend was sent off to Vietnam, and 6 months later, he sent her a present, and it was the ear of a Viet Cong to wear around her neck. And I thought, this is sick. This is sick. How could you take a nice young man and turn him into a monster? And so I became active in the anti-war movement. But after that, I wanted to do something to help hungry people around the world. And so I studied public health and nutrition. I started traveling around the world. I spent time in Africa and Latin America. And I saw there the effects of my government. Every time that there was a government in place that wanted to do something different, that wanted to really change the distribution of wealth, that wanted to make sure that kids didn't die of malnutrition, there was my government trying to overthrow it. And so I thought, wait, you know, I don't want to be the person putting the Band-Aids all the time. I want to get to the root of this problem. I came back to the United States. I studied political economy. I learned more about how the world works, about the power of corporations around the world, the history of my own government, which I learned from people in other countries. It took me going to Guatemala to learn that our government had overthrown their democratically elected government. You know, I went to Iran and found the same thing. I mean, you travel the world and you see the way that our government has destroyed so many beautiful possibilities of another world, a different world where we take care of each other, where we feed each other, where we love each other, where we don't kill each other. And so I reluctantly became involved. And Code Pink started, I had co-founded a group called Global Exchange. And there it was to take people around the world to see the world from other perspectives. Because, you know, at that time, I don't know what it is now, but only 5% of Americans had a passport. Mm. They didn't travel outside the United States. And I think seeing the U.S. through other people's eyes is so important. So that's a lot of the work that we did as Global Exchange. But then after 9/11, seeing how the U.S. was using that as an excuse to invade countries from Afghanistan to Iraq, we were at a meeting of women environmentalists and said, what are we going to do to stop the U.S. from invading Iraq? And that's when Bush had, you all might be too young. Do you remember the color-coded alerts?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, absolutely.
God bless you for thinking I'm too young.
Yellow, the orange, the red, and it was meant to keep people in a constant state.
Right. That's right. Yeah, that's
so
right.
So we said we need another color-coded alert. We were going to call it code hot pink because we didn't want to be code pink. It's too girly, you know. Code hot pink. Except we found that the URL was taken by a porn site. So we couldn't be code hot pink. We were just playing old code pink. And I must say, we lost a lot of women who were like, especially the New Yorkers who only wear black. You know, I'm not going to be in a group code pink, you know.
That's funny.
Anyway, over the years, I think we've recovered a lot of those people. But that was the origins of it. And you know, we never thought we were creating a long-term group. We didn't want to do that. We were all involved in all kinds of other important issues. I was doing issues around sweatshop labor. I was fighting against Nike and Reebok and Adidas for what they were doing overseas. I mean, we were doing things that you could actually see the progress. You could say, oh, this factory changed its conditions. These 20,000 people are now getting paid overtime. You know, those kinds of things. But after 9/11, we felt we had to do this. And we thought, you know, if we do our job as citizens and really organize and mobilize, we can stop. We couldn't stop Afghanistan, that invasion, but we could stop Iraq. And we did everything we could. You know, we were part of these massive, massive mobilizations where even the New York Times called us the second superpower in the grassroots movement.
That's incredible.
And yet, you know, we couldn't stop that war.
What was it like at the time? Because I think I remember this correctly. Let me know if I'm wrong. I feel like you were one of the chief boogeymen on Fox News since you were doing all this anti-war activism. What was that like? Did you experience things in person where it was like, okay, these people really dislike me? Or like you were describing, was it when you go to these anti-war rallies, everybody, it's all love and everybody's with you? What was it like at that time for you?
Well, I was on Fox News quite a lot, especially when there was a Democrat in the White House. So, you know, during Obama, I'd be on Fox News because they like people who criticize the Democrats. Mm-hmm. But I found that I enjoyed those occasions. I only got on CNN a couple of times. And
when a Republican was in the White House, was it?
Right.
You're right. Okay.
Of course.
And MSNBC, I have never been on, even though I was like a friend of Chris Hayes before he became an anchor. And I was told that I was banned from being on MSNBC. I mean, here I am. I guess I would consider myself to the left in the political spectrum. And I could only get on Fox News. And I enjoyed it because you reach a very different audience. And it's important to have dialogue in this country. It's important to have discussions. I have many family members who are Trumpers. And I, you know, we have very difficult but important discussions all the time. And I'm amazed, if I could just quickly get us up to what's happening now. I am amazed that we can only find, to my calculations, two members of the Republican Party that are saying, don't send more money to Israel.
Mm. Yeah.
It's just astounding.
What is it, Massey and Rand Paul?
No, Rand Paul, no. It's Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Wow.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. That's shocking.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, you never know, and you can't discount people because they're Republicans or they're Democrats. I mean, I feel those labels are, you know, not very useful these days. Left and right labels are not very useful, but I am surprised how few libertarians there are in Congress. You know, it used to be Ron Paul.
Ron Paul
was a real libertarian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he was very anti-war. Much stood against war. And yet, Rand Paul does not follow in those footsteps.
Yeah. Yeah. He's the worst version of his dad.
Now it's pretty much just Thomas Massey.
That's right.
He's the heir apparent to the Ron Paul throne. And he gets attacked relentlessly.
Well, and I don't see what he does to try to get his colleagues either, because we've talked to him and we've said, you know, we want to help you. We want to get more Republicans. Come on, you know. let's have a strategy here. And he's not,
interested.
He's kind of into being, I think, the lone wolf out there.
How does the response to your activism on Capitol Hill around stopping this genocide compare to the response during the Bush administration around the Iraq War?
Oh, I would say during the Iraq War, the response initially was, we are anti-American, we are unpatriotic. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the beginning, we were told that it was going to be a quick war.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to be over in 3 months, and it
That's
was going
right.
to cost
Mission accomplished.
$50 billion, and that was going to be repaid by the Iraqi oil. So, you know, in the beginning, there was a lot of hate, and we also got a lot of hate, not just from members of Congress, from veterans groups, from public who is rah-rah, U.S., we got to support our boys, because, you know, it's a big difference when it's our soldiers who are over there fighting and who are dying.
That's
and in
true.
Fact, we had a Code Pink activist house in D.C. that we started during the Iraq War, and we were picketed once a week.
Wow.
By those don't tread on me people with
wow.
the motorcycles who would come in. And we would always say, come on in, let's have a beer and talk about it. And they'd say, no, no, no.
We hate you, yeah.
Now I think, you know, I don't know even how to wrap my head around the fact that 6 months into this genocide, there are still so many members of Congress that are supporting this. But I think they're getting ashamed about it.
Yeah.
And I know they are, they can't stand when we come up to the, them and their cameras. They're just, you know, finding any way. We put out a thing about 10 ways that they avoid talking to us. You know, they run into the bathroom. They are suddenly talking on their phones. They're suddenly, their staff is getting in front of us to block them. Because they really, at first, they were talking a lot and they were saying, Israel, right or wrong, I don't care. I mean, even recently we had Brian Mast say to us that we don't want one penny of our money going to humanitarian aid because
that guy's a
they
psycho.
Voted for Hamas. We said, who is the they? Who is the they? A baby? A one-year-old? Who voted for Hamas? And you want to kill those children because somebody voted for Hamas? And he said, he just says, not one penny. We stand by Israel. They have to get the job done. But, you know, those people are starting to be fewer than they were before.
Even on the Republican side, or is that more of a
Even on the Republican
shame?
Side, we hear them say, we don't want so many people being killed, but the way to do that is for Hamas to surrender, you know, that kind of thing. They want to show they have some sympathy for Palestinian children, which— you know, at least is a little bit of movement, but, you know, just
that
rhetoric.
Guy, Brian Mast, he wore an IDF uniform in, you saw this,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
In Congress. And my immediate thought in that scenario was imagine somebody was wearing a Russian military uniform or
right.
an Iranian military uniform.
Oh, forget about
like, what? What the heck? And we also wonder, like, what is legal and what is not legal?
Right.
Like, there's so much of this. Of course, you know, AIPAC itself should be have to be registered as a foreign agent.
Of course.
And they have this education group that's separate from AIPAC that really is the same as AIPAC. It's in the same office. It's the same staff. It's the same board. I mean, everything. And they're the ones that pay for the Congress people to go. I mean, that should be illegal.
It's not just Congress people, too, by the way. When I got hired at MSNBC, guess who reached out to me about a
AIPAC?
Oh, yeah.
You're kidding.
You Absolutely. Never told me that.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God. That's crazy.
Yeah. So anybody who's going to be in any position of influence there.
And
by the way, I didn't go on the trip for those who were wondering.
That's
we
obvious.
Wanted to ask you, Crystal. Yeah. And sometimes I think there is so much pressure on Congress people that they go on the trip. Just because they don't want to keep being badgered.
Well, the way they pitch it to you, too, is like, oh, just, you know, it's going to be, they pitch it like this is going to be a vacation and the politics, that's not really relevant to what we're doing. We just want you to see the country and understand.
And we talk
you know,
to Palestinians,
so people think, oh, what's
too,
the harm
they
in that?
Say. We talk to Palestinians. Well, which Palestinians do you talk to? Where do you go? And we've had people who've gone to Israel many times and say to us, they've never seen any oppression of Palestinians. And we say, did you go to a place like Hebron? They say, oh, yeah, we went there. We didn't see it. We say, oh, what were you doing there? I mean, did you go there and put blinders on your eyes and just
right.
have somebody lead you around? So, yes, these, well, we were talking about how they're influenced. I mean, Brian Mast coming in his uniform, people like Congressman Trone, who's running for Senate, having an Israeli flag outside his office. The guy who accused Code Pink of taking money from the Chinese has an Israeli flag outside his office.
Oh, my God.
What
is this? I mean, there's no other flag of any other country out there. It's the American flag. And then they start putting these Israeli flags. It's just insanity. When you go into Congress, you really feel like you're in some kind of weird bubble.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you are. Have you noticed, I do think that the World Central Kitchen aid workers was an issue for Pelosi. It obviously got to Biden because, you know, you would think that the deaths of tens of thousands of Palestinians might get to them, but suddenly you have someone they know personally who's been directly impacted. Did you feel that shift in the response you were getting on Capitol Hill and the actions you were doing?
Absolutely. And this week we've been saying to them as we run after them, given the murder of the 7 aid workers of the World Central Kitchen, what do you think about continuing to send weapons to Israel? And, you know, they have to, well, they don't have to answer. They usually don't answer. But, you know, we would like to say, do you care about the 33,000 people who have been killed? And we've been saying that a lot, and they oftentimes say that it's because of Hamas. It's Hamas's fault. You know, it keeps going back to Hamas over and over and over again. So I do think that there is a big shift with the World Central Kitchen. We see and we kind of feel that shift among more of the mainstream Democrats.
Mm-hmm. So Israel just bombed an Iranian embassy in Syria. And there's all sorts of like unconfirmed reports that are coming out about a back channel between Iran and the U.S. and, you know, what they're discussing. But there's some pretty, you know, reputable outlets that are saying that an Iranian attack, retaliatory attack on Israel is likely. And then that, of course, by extension, puts the U.S. in the position of, well, we always say ironclad relationship with Israel will come to their defense, et cetera, et cetera. How fragile is this moment right now? Because it could be the calm before the storm, even though there's a literal genocide going on, but we're talking like World War III potential level type stuff here. How concerned are you about what's going to happen moving forward?
Absolutely. I mean, I really feel that this could easily blow up into a regional war. And we try to talk to members of Congress about that. And many of them just go back to this issue. Well, if Hamas would surrender, everything would calm down, as if, you know, that were the answer. And we've been to several hearings where they talk about the Houthis and what can we do? And they actually even say things like, we don't know what we can do to stop the Houthis from boarding ships on the high seas. And we yell out from the audience, stop the Israeli genocide.
Right.
That will stop the Houthis. You know, whether we're talking about the Houthis or this, you know, potential direct war that the Israelis have been wanting the U.S.
Right.
to be fighting with Iran directly, or what's happening in Lebanon or Syria. I mean, there are so many hotspots that could just explode. And when we say that's one reason that many people in the Congress are saying, well, that's why we have to still send weapons to Israel, because they are in such danger of their neighbors. And we're saying, well, they're the ones that are doing it. You know, they're the ones, if they stop this genocide, if they stop attacking all of their neighbors, then there wouldn't be this great need for, quote, defending Israel. So it's an argument I think we have to make more with members of Congress.
For the first time in my life, I don't think there would be a rally around the flag moment if the U.S. gets involved and goes to war with Iran on behalf of Israel. Do you agree with that? Because even during the Iraq War, I'm sure you remember this too, Crystal, it's like there was a rally around the flag. George Bush had, you know, whatever, 80% approval rating at the time or something crazy like that. I can't fathom the idea that if we end up going to war with Iran because Israel is as belligerent as they are, that the American people would be like, yeah, Biden, and his approval rating would go up, you know? Yeah,
absolutely. I think that would be disastrous. And I think the U.S. is trying to stop the Israelis from creating a war beyond the borders. But, you know, with an election coming up, I can't imagine that they think that would be a good thing for them.
That was the analysis of Dr. Trita Parsi when we spoke with him last, was that basically, you know, there has been this back channel with the U.S. and Iran that makes it really clear that neither one of them is itching for this fight. But you've got Bibi, who is this insane actor who has long wanted this direct confrontation and also is hanging on to power by, you know, his fingertips or his fingernails or the skin of his fingers or whatever the freaking expression is. He's barely hanging on. There we go. Skin of his teeth. That's the one. And so he's desperately trying to keep the war going and even expand it because he thinks that's his best path to holding on to power. So you might think on the one hand, all right, well, two out of the three parties don't want to escalate, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Bibi doesn't get his wish. And, you know, he is a very savvy and very nefarious actor.
And I must say that the Republicans in Congress are rabid about Iran. Mm-hmm. They're always talking about Iran, and they think that everything, you know, Hamas has no agency. It was all about Iran, that Hezbollah has no agency, all about Iran. Mm-hmm. Houthis, the same thing. Everything goes back to Iran.
And both the Americans and the Israelis said that Iran didn't actually have anything to do with the planning of October 7th. So I do think the American people would be like, what the hell are we doing here? Because also, it's not like we faced a direct attack the way that we did on 9/11 that triggered, you know, such a backlash and such a pro-war mania here.
Yeah, I'm really pleasantly surprised, I think, that the opinion polls that I look at don't show a real reluctance from the American public to get deeper and deeper involved in this war. And I think that is something that is a restraining factor, and that is going to change the calculus as we get closer to the elections. I mean, I think Biden's going to want to do something a little more dramatic to show some distance between him and Netanyahu to try to recover some of those voters that he is losing in swing states. I don't think he can do it. I think he's, for most people like myself, you know, I would never vote for Biden no matter what he did.
It's too
late. But I think he's going to try to recover.
Do you all have specific plans around the DNC or thoughts about what that might look
like? Shut it down. Shut it down, the RNC and the DNC. I think people should descend on Chicago and Milwaukee and just shut the city down. I mean, we are in a terrible moment in this country when we have people who do not represent us in the White House, don't represent us in Congress. The system is broken. We can't get money for basic needs for people, and yet we're spending about $1 trillion on the Pentagon. Dramatic things have to happen. And what is most encouraging for me in the last 6 months is seeing all the young people in this country who have been rising up, who have been taking action, who have been making the connections, people who see the connections between the environmental movement and what's happening in Gaza, who make the connections between the lack of money for whether it's affordable housing or for free college education, all of those things. So there is a new generation that is now seeing that it's not just this issue about Israel. It's a much larger issue, and it's a systemic issue. And when, you know, they're asked, and I know you've talked about this issue a lot on the show about the Biden-Trump issue, they're like, they're both awful.
Yeah. I wanted to, you probably didn't see this because you have better things to do with your time, but Jonathan Chait wrote quite a doozy of a column in New York Magazine that I wanted to get you to react to because you just, you know, we're talking about shutting down the DNC and the way that protesters have consistently bird dog Biden, his wife, Karine Jean-Pierre, wherever they go, they have to be confronted, which is something that I have found tremendously beautiful to watch. But he believes that these tactics are, quote unquote, illiberal and authoritarian. He wrote specifically, this pattern of behavior is illiberal and dangerous, drowning out speakers and disrupting exercises in politics, regardless of its cause or the target, is wrong on principle. Wonder what your reaction is to that.
Well, you know, we're doing it out of desperation. We're not doing it because we want to do this.
Right.
We're not doing it because we, you know, believe in shutting people down. We're doing it because they're not listening, because our voices are not being heard, because we're not being represented. You know, AIPAC doesn't have to do this kind of thing. You know, AIPAC, they go to Congress and they meet in the inner chambers with the senators and the representatives themselves. You know, we have to beg for a meeting with a staff person. So it's out of desperation. And, you know, when they say it's not nice to camp out outside Anthony Blinken's house and his children see you spilling that red paint in the driveway representing the blood on Anthony Blinken's hands, or it's not nice to lie down outside of the home of Nancy Pelosi, we say it's not nice to send 2,000-pound bombs to Gaza to destroy entire neighborhoods. It's not nice to kill journalists, not nice to kill doctors, academics, poets, children, so on. So this is a time where niceties, we have to put them aside.
Yeah. So there was a form of protest that I saw that I thought was really inspiring as well. The have you seen the, and perhaps you were involved, I don't know, you could tell me, all these protests that are blocking the ships with weapons that are supposed to go to Israel.
Oh, yeah.
That is, to me, almost like the platonic ideal of the way to try to fight back against this, because it's peaceful, it's nonviolent, but it also has the most tangible real-world impact imaginable, which is like, at the very least, you're delaying this ship from being used to do war crimes.
Right, and you're pointing out that right here in our ports, there are weapons that are going to Israel, and let's do something to shut that down. You know, over the years, the international longshoremen workers have been some of the most active to try to stop war, whether it was during the Central America days or Iraq. And now you have them as well as grassroots people who are going to the ports. And it's not just in the United States. It's happening in other places. And, of course, the Houthis are doing it in a different way. Mm-hmm. But, yes, I think it's great to try to stop the ships from going. I am going on a ship that we want to go to Gaza. I don't know if we're going to mention that.
Well, I wasn't sure if it's public yet.
Yes, we can talk about that,
which is
part of the Freedom Flotilla. And this is a tradition that in the beginning, when it first started, actually a couple of times the boats landed in Gaza. But then after that, the Israelis stopped the boats from going. And in 2010, they actually landed with by air on the boat and killed 10 of the people on board.
I remember that.
The Mavi Marmara. So this year, very soon, actually, we will be leaving very, very soon. And there are many hundreds of us, and we represent people from 30 different countries. And we will be bringing many, many tons of humanitarian goods to Gaza and trying to make it by ship. And, of course, we hope that we will make it. We are prepared if we don't make it. I mean, we are totally nonviolent. We hope that the Israelis don't come on board and start shooting people. But we are determined to go because we have to show that a couple of things. One, the Israelis are not letting in humanitarian aid. They are, and they should not be the ones to inspect this aid. We've had other inspectors, and they will come and inspect our boats, but not the Israelis, because they use any excuse to stop the aid from going in, and they don't have the legitimacy to be the ones to inspect that aid. And we want to show that Gaza should have the ability to use their ports, to use, they did have an airport, you know, until the Israelis bombed it, and to be able to come in and out by land. And that's why there is a siege on Gaza. And there was a siege on Gaza way before October 7th. And so we think it's important to try to break the siege of Gaza.
Do you coordinate with any governments before the flotilla leaves? Like, logistically, how does this work? And do you feel, I mean, in a very real, you're risking your life.
It's dangerous.
This is very dangerous. I mean,
we all know what the Israelis do.
Well, the Israelis are unhinged, so we don't know what they're going to do. And the only kind of coordination is that we are telling our governments, we are going to our members of Congress this week, for example, to tell them we're going on this, to tell them that we want them to tell the Israelis to let the ships in. So in that sense, I mean, it's not really coordination. It's informing them.
Yeah, letting them know this is happening. And have you gotten any sense from Congress or the Biden administration about how they'll approach it or what their response might be?
We haven't had that yet. We're just starting this week to publicize it. So we don't know that yet. But we certainly know that the Biden administration doesn't want to see American citizens killed. and that there will be foreigners, many of them from European countries, and they don't want to see their citizens killed. I mean, they've been fine about sending weapons to kill so many innocent people in Gaza, but when it comes to killing foreigners, if they're not Palestinian Americans, because there have been a number of Palestinian Americans That's killed, true. And the Biden administration hasn't done anything about that. But in any case, once we start our publicity, we think it's going to be a tough thing for them because how can they be against a group of people who are trying to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza and are trying to expose the Israelis' continued siege on Gaza? And so we hope that we will be getting support from various governments, if not the U.S. government, maybe some of the European governments, and of course governments in other countries that have been very much against what the Israelis are doing. I'm sure we will get supports from governments in the global south.
What's the hardest part of your journey being a legendary anti-war activist? What,
like, legendary, you know, just means old, but that's okay. No.
I wouldn't say that. No. Legit legend.
Iconic.
Iconic. There you go. That's a good word for it. What's the hardest part about doing it and throughout all these years? I mean, is it that, like, do you feel like it has the impact you want, or what about it is the hardest thing?
Well, I mentioned that I used to do work around things like sweatshop issues. We helped bring the fair trade label to the United States, doing things that you really could see the impact of your work. And you could say, wow, you know, we've changed the way this industry was functioning. In this, it's very, very hard to say what are your successes. I mean, you could say we helped get this political prisoner out of prison. We supported this whistleblower, you know, those kind of individual things. I always look for wood to knock on when I say we've helped to stop a war with Iran for all these years because you never know,
you never know
when it's going to start. But we were very active in trying to get the Iran nuclear deal passed. The hardest thing is that you don't see a lot of progress in your in the work you do, which made it, you know, over the years, made it hard to get young people to want to do this. Because if their choice is, I'm going to work on the environment and I'm going to get my university to use a fleet of electric cars and I can see that result of my work versus join the anti-war movement and you'll just be hitting your head against the wall for the rest of your life.
And not to mention relentlessly smeared and
relentlessly smeared in a variety of ways. And, you know, and you're going up against the military, industrial, security, academic, think tank complex, it is so enormous, that gets so much of our money, that has more lobbyists than there are members of Congress, and that has some piece of some weapons being produced in every single district in this country. I mean, how do you fight against that? You have to fight against it, but it's a long time thing, and it's you know, I'm not going to see the end of the military-industrial complex in my lifetime, but I think we have to keep fighting against it.
What's your sense of, like, the strongest impediment to peace? Is it the Pentagon? Is it the CIA? Is it the defense contractors? Is it the politicians? Is it the media? Who's, like, what's at the core of it?
I think money is at the core of it. I think this $1 trillion now that the U.S. is spending every year on militarism is going to build a lot of mansions in Virginia, in the suburbs of D.C. It's making a lot of people very wealthy. And the revolving door, I mean, look at Secretary of Defense Austin coming from the board of Raytheon, looking what Anthony Blinken did of working for a lobby firm that dealt with contracts for the Pentagon. I mean, all of these people are mucked up with weapons industry and money coming from the weapons company. So right now, when we're focused on Gaza, we look at the pro-Israel lobby. But I think behind it all, and even much more powerful, is the weapons industry speaking broadly and all the tentacles of that.
What do you make of a person like a Samantha Power or a Karine Jean-Pierre? I mean, I knew Karine. She started out as like an anti-Iraq war protester.
Let's move on, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Activated.
That's,
you know,
incredible.
That's what
that
activated me as well. And then you see her up there justifying these things that are unjustifiable. Samantha Power, her whole thing is being the great humanitarian. I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these trajectories from idealism to absolute horror. You know, what's your sense of that happens?
Power corrupts, and we see it at every level. I mean, I have friends who are part of the peace movement who got into the administration and won't resign.
Oh my God!
We're saying to them, "How could you not resign?" Well, I'm trying hard from the inside. Whatever, it's a power trip. You know, it's you convince yourself that you can do more on the inside than on the outside. Mm. Some people do that.
Yeah.
Samantha Power. You know, at the hearing yesterday, I was so disgusted because, first of all, when she mentioned Gaza, she said it so fast that I couldn't even hear what she was saying about it.
Mm.
But more than that, she talked about China in her opening statement for a long time, and talking about China as a threat because China has the Belt and Road Initiative and has created the most debt among countries of the global south of any country. And I'm just thinking, does she really believe what she is saying? Does she really feel okay about putting China out there as an enemy? And you can see that in these people that you think, do they really believe what they're saying?
Right.
And what happened to their whole persona of saying, how do we end violence? How do we prevent genocide? How do we look for ways to cooperate with each other? And I mean, gosh, that's just so much of what we need in this world right now. We can't have countries being our enemies. We have to have find ways to use diplomacy. And I think that's what makes me so angry about Anthony Blinken and so excited about the camp out that's been outside his home steadily every single day, because he's supposed to be a diplomat. And what is he doing? What is he doing to stop the war in Ukraine? What is he doing to stop the Israelis? He's not doing anything. He's doing just the opposite. So we've lost the whole. I mean, if we ever had a strong State Department, it's now an appendage of the Pentagon.
Yeah, I think there's some ideological Kool-Aid drinking that goes on. I mean, a lot of this is the money and follow the money, and you know that really impacts people and their position. But I do think a lot of it, they really drunk the Kool-Aid on this very simplistic notion of like, we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. When we do something evil or bad or wrong or a war crime, it doesn't really count because we mean it with good intentions and it was an oopsie, right?
Well,
when others
oopsie,
do it.
You know, look at the Iraq war, oops.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Look at Afghanistan.
And by the
way,
this is a good question to ask you. At what point did you realize that Code Pink was totally validated and vindicated over the Iraq? Because I remember, I'll tell you the moment I thought was the 2015, 2016 Republican debates, the primary.
Mm.
It was in a military state, I believe, South Carolina. Jeb Bush was on stage with Trump and all the other ones. And Trump shouted at Jeb Bush that the towers came down under your brother. He didn't keep us safe. And the Iraq war was a big fat mess, or like a big fat mistake. And he got a military audience in South Carolina
to applaud.
A room full of hardcore right-wing Republicans, all applauding. And at that moment, and it was actually Ben Shapiro, shockingly made a decent point. He said, if Trump can make that audience applaud in that debate, in that state, with that point, this thing's over. It's done. And so for me, it was like 2015, 2016. Even the people who were the biggest propagandists in favor of the war, like Bill O'Reilly, even he was like, oh, yeah, well, great. Well, maybe that one wasn't that good. You know what I mean? When did you feel totally vindicated about that one?
Well, it took a while. I mean, we knew we were right.
Of course, yeah.
Although, you know, you never know at some point. Maybe they are going to have a 3-month war. You know, maybe it will be quick.
Maybe there are WMD.
Right.
But, you know, we were in Iraq. We went to Iraq right before, in February, right before the invasion, thinking that the invasion might even happen. I mean, you know, that took a lot of guts to Iraq when we thought the U.S. might be starting the war. And we were there when Colin Powell was at the U.N.
Mm.
And we had been going out every day to cheer the weapons inspectors on. We got up early in the morning. We'd go out and see their cars go out. And we said, thank you, thank you, thank you. And we talked to them. And they said, there are no weapons of mass destruction.
Mm.
So we knew it. Everybody in Iraq knew it.
Mm.
You know? Wow.
So in any case, you know, we have been right all along, no matter what it was. We have been right. And yet we're still treated like we're some fringe crazy people. And I just am astonished that so many of the pundits that were in favor of the Iraq war, that were cheerleading for the Iraq war, are still pundits today. You know, they're still on CNN. They're on. They get on to MSNBC.
Yeah. Right. And they bury that part of their history.
They bury that
They
part
act
of their
like, of course I was against it. Yeah, you know what I mean?
You weren't. Jonathan Chait earlier, I did a monologue on his whole column because it just drove me absolutely insane. And so I dug up some of his Iraq war takes, and I found this column he wrote in the Washington Post after the invasion, when it was starting, the whole WMD thing was starting to come apart. And he's there in the Washington Post castigating liberals for daring to consider that maybe the left is right and calling it, like, you know, dangerous and disastrous for them to go along with these just Bush-hating lefties who can't see straight because of their, you know, their animus towards George W. Bush. So even at that point, he was still like, you got to stay in line. You got to believe the dream about the WMD. And it, here he is still, you know, out there to bash protesters who are trying to stop a genocide as being illiberal and authoritarian. Given what you said about how difficult the work is and how little progress you can actually see, what does keep you going?
Well, I see what's happening in places like Gaza. I saw what happened during the invasion of Iraq. I've been to Afghanistan even after the Taliban took over again. I've been to Yemen, seeing the effects of U.S. drone strikes there. Been to Waziristan in Pakistan, seeing the effects of U.S. drone strikes, and meeting these families time and time again whose loved ones have been killed by our bombs, by our drones, by our support for repressive regimes. And I just feel that it's my obligation as a U.S. citizen. You know, I used to work for the U.N. I love living in other countries. I really do. I love that every day is a new experience, new food, new people, new culture, new language. It's so much fun. It's so stimulating for the brain. And yet I feel it's my job to be here. It's my job to be in D.C. It's my job to go to Capitol Hill every single day. I feel it's an obligation. Is it what I want to do? I'm 71 years old. I would like to, you know, be basking in the sun somewhere in a nice tropical country. But I don't feel that I can do that. And I feel that silence is complicity. And I feel that I'm lucky enough to be able to do this work. I had a friend I wrote a book on in Honduras who was a victim of U.S. Military there being tortured. And she was going out day after day after day trying to organize. And I said, you know, don't you want to just stop? And she said, don't you get depressed? And she said, you know, that's a luxury we can't afford.
Mm.
And that's what I feel like every day. If I'm tired, I think it's a luxury I can't afford.
Is Code Pink basically doing stuff daily on Congress?
Yeah, now I'm here in D.C. In the meanwhile, my colleagues in Code Pink and volunteers all over the country are doing things in their places. They're part of Let's Stop the Ships from Going, Let's protest at the weapons companies, Let's go to the offices of our their Congress people. I mean, they're doing it all over the country. I just happen to be here, and we get a lot more visibility because we're in D.C. And, you know, we just put it out to everybody, come and join us. In fact, to your listeners, we say, we meet every day at 10 a.m. in the Rayburn Cafeteria. That's on the House side, the Rayburn Building. You will meet the most diverse group you can imagine. I mean, a couple of days ago, we had a great, there's an elder Israeli man, Shlomo, who comes with us. And there was a young mechanic who is a Palestinian, and he has family in Gaza. And the two of them just met each other, and they went to a congressional office, and Mohammed put his arm around Shlomo and said, I want you to hear from my good friend Shlomo, who knows about the Holocaust. And, you know, those That's kinds beautiful. Of wonderful friendships happen every single day because you look around at the people you're with and you say, I would never meet these people under any other circumstances. And now I consider them my family. I love these people. And so we encourage people to come. People take a day off. They call in sick. They come and join us. Retired people come. You know, we do have a lot of students. So anybody who's listening or watching who wants to join us, it's a very good experience. It's a way to get out your frustration yelling at these congressmen.
Yeah. So I know there's plenty of people who've been watching what's been happening in Gaza, and they just feel so like helpless, you know, when you look at the number of hospitals that have been bombed and schools that have been destroyed and civilians being purposefully killed, and it's on camera and there's no even remotely there's no remote ability to even try to deny it. You know, it's so dark. And I know people feel like, man, I want to do something about this. I just feel like I can't just watch this happen and do nothing. Well, there you go, guys. Now, here's your opportunity. If you want to actually get directly involved, you want to go protest politicians, you want. And the thing I really like about you, too, is that you're very strategic with how you do it. You know what I mean? It's not just like blind rage and let's just hope it works out. It's very, like you said before, it's like there's the carrot, there's the stick approach. They do something good. Hey, good job. You know,
we strategize. We sit around in the morning and we say, okay, so-and-so is going to introduce a new bill. There's a resolution here. Here's one we're in favor of. Here's one we're against. Let's quickly do up a sheet that we can take with us. And so we are very strategic and we learn from each other. I've learned so much from all the people who come because they have different arguments that they use. And, you know, people have said that the only time they're not feeling depressed is when they're going with us, or
right,
they're out in front of the encampment outside the Israeli embassy, or they're outside in front of Anthony Blinken's house, and people, you know, feel like at least I'm doing something. And when I'm doing something and I'm with people who are doing something, I feel energized. And that's what gets me out of bed, running out of bed, getting right on my bicycle, getting over to Congress to say it's another day to try to stop a genocide.
So guys, don't be shy. Go be with Code Pink and you'll feel like you're doing something productive, because you will be doing something productive.
Yeah, that was the something similar that Motaz said to me as well. And I mean, he's lost 100 plus family members in Gaza.
Unconscionable.
I don't even think I know 100 family members. I can't even wrap my head around what that
means. For people who don't know him, he is a PhD student, brilliant. And he, I don't know how he can stay in his PhD program, because he's been going with us every day in Congress and pouring his heart out and telling the Congress people, look me in the eye. I am a Palestinian. My family is from Gaza. Listen to me. We have a So I just give him so much credit and have so much respect for him doing that. And for the other Palestinians who come with us on a regular basis, you know, some of them, they are crying every day, whether they're in Congress with us or not in Congress. You know, they are thinking every day, you know, you have a cup of water and you're drinking it and you're thinking about who doesn't have water, clean water in Gaza. You go to sleep at night and you're thinking about how lucky I am to have a roof over my head. And when we go to the cafeteria to eat, you know, we think about the people in Gaza who can't make a choice between, oh, I think I'll have salad today or I'll have this sandwich. So the people who join us, and especially people like Taz, I mean, it's a real anguishing thing for him to do, but he feels like he has to do it. There's another woman, Summer, who is from Palestine, who comes with us. And I love going to with her, because she just goes right in the face of these members of Congress. And she said, I'm a Palestinian. Do you see me? Do you hear me? Do you know that I exist? Will you acknowledge me? Will you acknowledge my people? Will you acknowledge that you are killing my people? You have blood on your hands. And, you know, it's a tough thing for them to do, but they're going around with us, and it's important to expose the racism of these people, the lack of humanity. Mm-hmm. And for some of them, I must say, I think it's the first time that they're confronted by a Palestinian.
Do you ever see moments where they can't help but actually allow some humanity to break through?
Absolutely. I certainly do see that. I mean, when Taz went in and started pulling out the computer and showing the names of all his family members, you could see the staff tearing up. And we've had staff who've had blowouts. We're talking to them, and all of a sudden, they are just sobbing and sobbing. And today, you know, we were in the hearing around the journalists, and we took out pictures of the journalists, and we read their stories. And you could see the people really being emotional about it when you are confronted with these are real people. These are not just numbers. These are people who had hopes and dreams and families and loved ones. And so that's a way to get to people, is to humanize the Palestinians.
My last question for you, Medea, is how has your work and the experiences you've had, good, bad, indifferent, how does it make you think about the functioning of our democracy, our democracy?
Well, we talked about this a little earlier in saying shut down the RNC and the DNC. I think our democracy is absolutely broken. I think this country is just in need of a real revolution. I mean, we have such incredible inequality in this country that, you know, I've lived in so many other places around the world. Do you know in Iraq before the U.S. invasion, you could become a PhD, a doctor, anything from the university all the way up to what you wanted for not only free, you'd get a stipend.
Wow.
Because they were glad that you wanted to study, educate yourself, and contribute to society. There are a lot of countries that are way poorer than us that have health care. I mean, I don't have good health care. I have Medicare, and I can't find there are places I go that say we don't take Medicare.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, our system is so, so, so broken. And you know, on my way over here, riding my bike over here, I saw tents of people who were without housing. I saw people lying in the streets. And I think, you know, this is our nation's capital. This is not the way it's supposed to be. And so our system is totally broken. And this is just, you know, this particular issue we're talking right about now is just a reflection of how broken it is.
My final question for you is, how will history look at this moment? Because early on, I started to get the sense like, this feels like a genocide, looks like a genocide. And then as time went on, I only got more validated in that perspective. But there are still people who are skeptical when you bring like, hey, we're going to look back on this. Like we're living in, you know, 1940. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So you agree that's how history will judge this moment?
Yeah. I mean, I've been going back and watching Holocaust documentaries and watching also what happened in 1948 in the Nakba. And I'm just seeing that this is what is happening. We are living this now. We are seeing this now. And we have no excuses.
Right.
Because anybody who wants to get educated can go on social media, can watch a program, can do so many things to learn about the issues, but we're letting it happen. And so I think history will condemn what Israel has done, but I think it will condemn us, and especially us in the United States, who have been paying for this for many, many, many years. Because let's remember, this is not new. Mm-hmm. We have been giving $3.8 billion to a wealthy country that has a better healthcare system and an education system than ours. We have been doing that constantly under Democratic presidents, under Republican presidents. And so we are definitely complicit in this genocide.
Mm. Well, Medea, I'm in awe of you. I admire your persistence, your moral clarity, your personal courage. Thank you. I think we all owe you a debt for the work that you've been doing for so many years now. And of course, thank you so much for spending some time with us here today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I think we're going to get a lot more people coming to join us in the Rayburn Cafeteria.
I hope so.
Thank you. Great.
Awesome.